This is an interview with Kayleen Smith. It's taking place in Town Hall House in Kent Street in Sydney. The project is the Homeless Persons Information Centre Oral History Project. It's being conducted on behalf of the City of Sydney's History Program. I'm Margot Beasley and the date is the 22nd of April 2009. Kayleen, would you mind introducing yourself? Give me your full name and tell me where and when you were born.
Yeah, so my full name's Kayleen Smith, and I was born here in Sydney. Do you know the date?
No, that's fine. Thanks very much. I should just say before we continue that we'll be using the acronym HPIC, which is short for Homeless Persons Information Centre. So when we say HPIC, that's what we mean. Now, Kayleen, I'm talking to you because you're, I think, possibly the longest term working for HPIC for the City of Sydney, is that right?
Yes, I've been there for 11 years, minus the two stints of maternity leave. And Susie had started before me, but she'd left for a period of time and came back, So she's actually been there, I suppose. She was there before me, so she had a bit more history, I suppose, in that way. But in length of time, I suppose, yeah, it's myself and then Mauricio and Anita. So the four of us have been pretty much there for close to 9 to 11 years. So.
What's Mauricio's last name?
Paraguez.
And Anita?
And Susie's is Susie.
Right. So when you first started with the centre, what sort of work were you doing?
So I started as a referral officer on the phones. So back then it was more talking to the person on the phone, having a sheet of paper with like codes and stuff on, so we'd write their name and tick different boxes for, you know, whether they had drug or alcohol, things like that. So we didn't really have a computer database back then. We had a few things we could search, accommodation and service providers, but we couldn't bring up past client details or anything like that. So everything was on paper. So as we speak to the client, we'd gather all their details and just trying to place them. And then someone would go, we'd have a data entry person, would then enter all that information. So
So your job basically was to take inquiries from anybody in Sydney or wider than that?
Still in New South Wales. So it's not sure when it started becoming a New South Wales based service. When it originally started, it was just a shopfront in Sydney. So I'm not sure when it actually expanded from there. But yeah, when I started back in 1998, it was a statewide service then. So we'd be taking inquiries from people who are homeless or at risk of homelessness and trying to find them a service or give them advice on something that may prevent them from being homeless or, you know, helping with rent arrears, where they could get assistance for that sort of stuff.
So what do you know about the service before you came? You said it was formerly a shopfront.
Yeah, from some of the stuff that I had read, and I worked in a youth service before, and on the management committee was a gentleman by the name of Alan Burns, and he actually worked for the City of Sydney, and he had been, after I started Homeless Persons, had informed me that he was one of the original ones in setting up the Homeless Persons Information Centre. He said then originally it was just a shop front set up for people to come in, take a few, you know, help people who are homeless, and, you know, they'd get a few people sort of each day. But from there, somewhere along the line, obviously grew, and I'm not sure what stage it did, then becoming a telephone information service. And then went on to then cover the whole of New South Wales. So from what I can understand from Alan was that, yeah, originally it was just set up as a shopfront in the city for people within the city who were homeless. So
a shopfront could only have dealt with people who were, in a sense, immediately local.
Yeah.
They had to physically present at the shopfront.
Yeah, I think they had a phone. I don't think there's specific purpose back then. And I haven't looked at all the stuff from there, but I don't think the specific purpose back then was a telephone information centre. So I think it was more like a drop-in, come and get some advice and some help from there, and obviously expanded as the need grew, I suppose.
So when you came on, it was fully telephone service.
Yep.
Were you in this building, Town Hall House?
We were, yeah, Town Hall House, and I think back then it was level 13. Just in a very small office, we used to call it the fishbowl because we were like in the centre of the floor, just with this glass window around us. So, it was a much smaller office. I think there was still 2 to 3 people on the phones plus the manager at the time. And it was just taking in virtually like people who are homeless ringing in, getting their details and trying to find a most appropriate service or information to give them. So,
How would people know to ring the service then and now?
Obviously, because we've been going for 25 years, we're a very well-known service. Most people who become homeless or risk of homelessness would either attend like a charitable organisation like St Vincent de Paul, Salvation Army, things like that. All those services, including the police, local hospitals, refuges, all have our number. So then anyone who accesses any of the services seeking assistance would normally be given our number. And in Department of Housing, we're very close links with Department of Housing. All Centrelink offices know of our service as well. So usually anyone has to go to any of the charitable welfare services and usually be given our number to seek accommodation.
And is it in the phone book?
I'm pretty sure it was at one stage and it was taken off, and I'm pretty sure it's back into, I think, the white pages now at the front. So,
sort of like an emergency number.
So, service assistance. And I know a lot of clients have said that, they'd called Telstra to find out if there was a number they could call. So they obviously all know, it's got some sort of thing there to ring us as well. So, we've got cards that we distribute to homeless people and to services, so people just give those out, like just wallet size cards, so a lot of people keep those on them as well. So,
and now you're funded by the City of Sydney
and SAP, which is the Supported Accommodation Assistance Program.
So SAP's another acronym, SAPP.
Most refuges and
SAAP, I beg your pardon.
SAAP, sorry, yeah. So most refuge services and accommodated through SAP, which is part of the Department of Community Services. And we also get a small amount of funding from the Department of Housing as well. And we originally got that as when the brokerage program was set up. So Department knows the outreach. Well, now I'm a bit
confused.
That's
okay.
So I think it was the outreach year when that was set up, and the Department of Housing had funded some of those, that they gave us a small pool of funds as well because we were sort of managing the programs. So, but majority of the funding now seems to come from the City of Sydney. So.
But it's a service that is statewide.
Yep, we're a statewide service,
So I'd like to talk a bit about the difference between when you first came here and how things are now. So perhaps you might just start with talking about what your daily work was like.
Yeah.
When 11 years ago when you began here, what kinds of things were you doing?
It mainly sort of... Most of the majority of the work includes like telephone information, so most of our role is just taking calls from clients. Though in quieter periods back then we'd be updating accommodation service providers, we may be helping with data entry, just chasing up things, helping the manager at the time if there was anything that needed to be chased up. A lot quieter than what it is now. Where I suppose now, back when I started as a referral officer, and then at the end of 1998, I was appointed the senior referral officer, which meant then that my role had changed a little bit. I'd do a lot more of the admin sort of side, finance side, things like that. We're now sort of, changed a lot. We've got a lot more staff. Back then, I think we had 6.5 full-time equivalent staff, and we were here till I think 7 o'clock at night.
7 days a week?
No, then weekend. We did open weekends back then, but it was shorter hours, and we didn't open public holidays. We're back in, I think it was about 2000 or 2001. We got permission to extend our hours to then become 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. 7 days a week, including public holidays. So that meant that we had to put extra staff on to cover those. And at the same time, when I first started, the nights and weekends were sort of mainly covered by one staff member, like a bit more sort of evening shift. Then when we extended, we still stayed with one staff member for a length of time. Then it was becoming more of an OH&S thing, in that it was safety concerns for people leaving the building late at night or working for themselves. They had no one to debrief with or distress with on a difficult call. So then we put on, we got the approval to put on extra staff, so there was no lone operator shifts, as we would call them back then, and there was two people working nights and weekends. So I suppose back when I first started, there was minimal staff, not as longer hours. We're now, we're 7 days a week. We're now up to 12 staff in total, which is, I think is a total of about 8.5 EFT. But you don't quote me fully on that. I'm always up to date. And I suppose that their services have changed a lot more. And back then, we only had sheets of paper to write on. Now we... as we answer calls, we enter directly to screen. We had a new database set up back in early 2000s, I think it was about 2001, 2002, and which helped a lot because then we could enter the client's information. We'd have a good history of it. So the next time that person called, we could bring up their details and all the information was there. So where before we had nothing to sort of go on, we didn't really have much information. Now we've got like a full history where it's helpful for us in placing clients, having a bit of an idea if there's been any warnings on them, any problems in the past, if there's messages to pass on to the client. If there's a service working with them quite extensively, you know, you could ring and say, next time he calls, can you just leave a message? So we've got all that whole history there now. So we can take contact details, more information on, special needs like drugs or alcohol, mental health, that sort of stuff. And we're in the process at the moment of redesigning the whole database to even be able to provide a bit more, because of the number of calls we're taking, which has grown drastically over the last couple of years. The database is not being able to sustain so many clients, so we're in the process of developing a new database to be able to work with the number of clients that we do and to give better reporting and statistical analysis as well, I suppose. So,
is that database controlled for privacy issues?
Yeah, not everyone has access. You have to have special permission to use the program, so not everyone can access it, and data reporting and things like that is only through Mauricio. He is the only one who can do the data reports, and I think Anita at the moment. So there's special things that prevent some staff accessing, just so that it's not, you know, just printed off willy-nilly. I suppose being council, we can't just send statistics to anyone. There's specific protocols around that and stuff as well. So
You say Maurizio does the data reports, you mean he collects the data?
He does. The data is all collected through the program that we use on the computer. Everything that we enter actually goes into back-end data and recorded into specific fields. So he can actually do specific runs on different areas, total number of callers, if we wanted to see how many people were placed at a specific refuge. So he can do the statistical breakdown of what has to be needed, or what is needed for specific services if they require it, and for the city on what we can report back on. So
those figures, I guess, amount to some fairly comprehensive social research in a way, do they? Do they look at things like the reasons for why somebody might be presenting as homeless?
Yep. And there's just a lot in the media in the last month around the number of homeless people within the city, and homeless people in general, because of all that's happening within society. And it actually picked up that, you know, back when I first started, your typical homeless person would be the long-term homeless guy, drug or alcohol issues or gambling issues. We're now, with that data, it's shown that the trend has completely changed, and the main reason for homelessness at the moment is housing stress. So it could be like crisis, eviction, someone hasn't paid their mortgage, who's being evicted, haven't paid rent, people being evicted for selling, the property's being sold, person wants to move back in. So we can collect all that data and stuff now, so it shows us actually why person, the reasons for homelessness, and shows us the trends. And it can also show us, like, back there originally, you know, it was drug and alcohol, and now you can show the increase in heroin use or amphetamine use, gambling, how much that's becoming a problem, mental health, that sort of stuff. So you can do specific runs on different things to show, the trends over the years and stuff as well. Yeah.
So what you're saying about what's happening now, that many of these people are people who don't otherwise have social problems, but they are simply losing their accommodation for one economic reason or another. But they're basically financially based.
Yeah, some of them may have, you know, it might be that they haven't paid rent. And a majority of our clients are still on like a Centrelink payment. But yeah, because of rent increases and being harder to find rental properties now, that they're being evicted or haven't paid their rent. So that's the main sort of reason now to why people are becoming homeless. So
yes, we probably should talk a bit about, I think really what you're referring to is the, in Sydney in particular, and perhaps it's so in regional centres as well, is the increasing cost of rental and bought accommodation. If somebody was listening to this in 50 years' time, the situation may be different, but this is a very acute issue in Sydney now anyway, isn't it, over the last few years?
Well, obviously, because with the all the mortgage stuff and the interest rate hikes that went up over the last couple of years, obviously brought a lot of the rental prices up for a lot of places who, for investors who had mortgages and stuff. So which brought the whole market up. So the whole rental market has gone up to, you know, ridiculous prices. And a normal client, maybe mum with children on a Centrelink benefit, just couldn't sustain the cost. So
what sort of rent might you be looking at?
At the moment, even for like just a two-bedroom unit, the minimum would be $250, $300 a week. So, and if you're a mum, you know, with one child, you're like, if you're getting sort of, you know, $700 a fortnight, that's a fair amount. You know, if you're looking at $300 a week, you're not left with much over a fortnight to buy food and electricity, you know, pay for your bills and stuff like that as well. So, so it's certainly difficult, and to find affordable housing now is really, is very hard if you're on a Centrelink payment. A few years ago, what we just sort of did was if there's someone was homeless and we couldn't find a refuge, or that we thought they would be better off in more low-cost housing, we'd then give them numbers for boarding houses and caravan parks to try as well as low-cost sort of, you know, housing measure. There was not a lease or anything like that, but it was affordable. You'd get a boarding house room for maybe $100 a week. Where now, even with the economic times and the rent prices going up, a lot of the boarding houses are now full. There's no, very rarely ever get a vacancy in one of the services, because people just can't afford to move out into other places, so they're not generating those vacancies in those sort of services. Caravan parks are just full as well. So we're finding it really difficult not only to try and get people into refuge, but to low-cost housing as well, because it's just near impossible to obtain now. So even like with refuges where, you know, like 10 years ago, you'd have, you know, a single mum with a child or a family, first or second call, you'd get them into a service or services all the time, you know, vacancies pretty regularly. Where now, you're lucky, a lady could be ringing every day for 3 to 4 weeks, and you still may not even place her after that period of time. So just that there's, yeah, lucky if you get one vacancy in a women and children's service a day. You're lucky if you get a family vacancy once every few weeks. And so when you've got a majority of your callers being, you know, single mums or families, it's near impossible place. So Department of Housing is sort of picking up that slack a little bit and putting people in motel through their temporary accommodation program. But yeah, that's only usually a maximum of 4 weeks or 28 days in a 12-month period. So at the end of that time, it's, if you haven't got anything, it's, yeah,
back on the streets.
And for us, because we're mandatory reporters to the Department of Community Services, if there's risk of children sleeping in cars and things like that, then we need to make a notification too. So, and if it, you know, gets to the stage where that Department of Community Services is seen as risk, then a lot of the time the children may be taken from the parents. So something that we try to avoid, and we try, against all odds, you know, encourage. And DOCS, Department of Community Services, philosophy, it's not so much to try and take the kids from the family, but to try and keep them together. But if there is a need that, you know, there's no other accommodation provided, then kids may be taken into temporary care until something else is found.
So that's a fairly drastic outcome of homelessness.
And it's something that, you know, we don't like to see happen, and very rarely does happen, but there are times when it's needed and necessary to prevent kids being on the streets or sleeping in cars and things like that. So it is, yeah, it's certainly getting a lot worse than what it was 10 years ago. Times have certainly changed. You know, and I suppose for us, the whole sort of face of homelessness has changed. A lot more draining, I suppose, and tedious for staff, like you're getting a lot of people more of emotional problems, mental health problems, you know, who want to vent their frustrations and stuff. So you get a lot of abusive callers, you know, people suicidal, very emotional, people maybe leaving domestic violence. So staff, they're not trained counsellors, are sort of still doing that basic counselling work to, you know, to comfort people, reassure them and try and give them that bit of hope, I suppose. So.
When you say they're not trained as counsellors, because what you are is a referral service rather than a counselling service, but what are they trained as? Because obviously some counselling comes into it. I mean, if you're dealing with people in extreme stress with a lot of associated problems, you must have some skills in that direction.
I think a lot of the time, because most of us have been there for a while, back when we first started, it wasn't a requirement that you had to have welfare qualifications or anything like that, because it was a lot quieter and things like
and
that.
And so it was just a straight referral service.
What
backgrounds might people have come out of then?
There's a couple from welfare, or they may have come as students originally from like a TAFE course or university course and then come in that way, so they hadn't had a lot of experience in the welfare. Some people just come from administrative backgrounds, you know, hospitality. So people wanting a bit of a change. That, you know, a lot of our staff had come from casuals. We use Spectrum Employment, who are a labour cop service, and they do all the casual sort of wages and stuff like that for us. So what usually happens is that we recruit casuals, and some of those may have come from our students that we've put through as casuals. And then as a position comes available, because they're trained, they come through us that way. But majority of staff wouldn't have had a lot of welfare or background. I've sort of done counselling myself and come from, you know, a fair few years experience in welfare and doing welfare courses. But some staff have just come through administrative or hospitality and that sort of way, where now the requirement is that they need to have sort of had some sort of welfare experience or qualification, just because to have that bit of knowledge around sort of stuff. But a lot of it is just on the job sort of training, sort of, you know, like it's just because we do foster a strong team approach to everything, you know, we try not to judge clients, and that's something we push quite regularly with staff, and to try and be empathetic. So, you know, just being empathetic sometimes helps and reassures. So, and you pick up that basic sort of, you know, if you've got good communication skills and listening skills, then you can do that sort of basic support and counselling with clients. But we'd sort of never delve into too much of the person's emotional background or past background and bring up all these emotions that we know that we can't deal with. So. Because we're only, you know, we're really only dealing with the client with a short period of time. We don't want to sort of raise too many sort of issues that, you know, the client then is then harbouring, and they're not going to get the support when they leave. So,
And I guess sometimes the problem too is that people ring the homeless person's information centre, thinking possibly that might mean that their homelessness problem can be solved.
Yeah,
but it doesn't mean that at all, does it? It means you can attempt to solve it or attempt to refer them to an agency that might be able to help.
I think some people who have never used our service before are not quite sure what we can provide. So some people ring saying, you know, they want a 3-bedroom house in a particular area, and we have to explain to them, well, that's not what we provide. We can look at, you know, getting them into refuge accommodation somewhere. But that may mean leaving the area that they're in. So, you know, refuges are all scattered around. There's not refuges in every suburb. So, you know, and it's then encouraging people to you know, uproot themselves and their children if it means getting a roof over their head. So in that sort of aspect, people sort of are not sure, or they think that, you know, by ringing us, they're going to get a Department of Housing place straight away, especially if they're calling from Department of Housing. So a lot of the time, it's in the initial call, it's explained to the client what we can do and can provide. Especially if someone's been down to the Department of Housing, what they do, you know, they'll get the client to ring us first, check for vacancies in a refuge, and then they might put a person up for a week in a motel and say that the part of that requirement is that they call homeless persons every day. Well, a lot of clients don't even understand why they're calling us every day, and they think they're just getting the motel for the week. And then when you explain, no, the reason that you're calling us every day is, you know, because we need to try and find you refuge accommodation. So, well, that's not what I want. So there, for us, it's explaining to that service, you know, to the person what we can provide, and you know, trying to be realistic for them as well, that, you know, they need to make an effort to apply for as many private rental places as they can. They're looking for other accommodation, but at the same time ringing us to try and access crisis accommodation. So they don't know. Yeah, they think they're just going to call and we're going to fix their problem straight away. We've even had calls from overseas, so New Zealand and I think there's one in America or something at one stage, and even emails from overseas saying they're coming to Australia soon, what sort of housing can they provide? Well, they've been given our number, say, you know, call homeless persons, they'll find you a house. So, you know, so you get people turning up from the and they're ringing from the airport, and you've got to try and be realistic, and especially if they're not on income, it's going to be awfully hard to sort of place them in a service. So
they would be people who, they're not your standard run-of-the-mill tourist.
No.
They'd be people who may be returning from overseas with no money and no accommodation.
Yeah, we have clients of Mediterranean or, you know, an ethnical background who have family still overseas, so they may have been here for a couple of years renting, then, you know, they want to go back home and see their family. They may have been there a couple of years, come back not realising how difficult it is now to get accommodation, have nothing planned, think, oh, well, I'll ring homeless persons, they'll have something, we'll get something that night. So a lot of people, yeah, sort of don't realise that, you know, sometimes it is very difficult and you can't just place that night. And, you know, we also get a lot of people ringing from interstate, so saying, you know, they're coming up to Sydney in a couple of days, what can we provide? And it's trying to explain to them, you know, you're best off trying to have something before you get here, or have some money as a backup if you need to put yourself in a motel, because we can't guarantee that we're going to be able to place you straight away. So,
Are there ways in which you might define homelessness? Are there some people who, strictly speaking, don't qualify? Like perhaps they do actually have enough money to pay for private accommodation?
Yeah, it depends. Usually if there's one service in particular that if you're working, then you're not suitable for their service, because it's people who are not working can't afford their own accommodation. A lot of the services, majority of them, you need to be eligible for some sort of income, either through Centrelink or, you know, or working. Back, I suppose, 10 years ago, people would go into refuge, and part of their policy was that, you know, you didn't have to pay. For some reason, you couldn't afford to pay rent, then part of the Supported Accommodation Assistance Program policy was that, you know, that you take people in who are homeless with no funds. Where now it's changed that because there hasn't been a lot of top up in funding in these services, then they're now relying on the rent from clients to be able to keep their service running. So the majority of the services now, if you're not in receipt of an income from Centrelink or working, then you can't access the service. So or otherwise they might give you one or two nights and that's it. So most services they'll give you maybe 2 to 3 nights credit without being paid, and after that you need to pay to stay there. So if you're someone's come from overseas and not here as a citizen or permanent resident, and not entitled to a benefit for a couple of years, it's near impossible to place them. So then it's, you know, trying to get them to go to the local embassy or consulate to sort of get a bit of advice around that, trying to find a family member, finding work. For people who come over like on a bridging visa or asylum seekers, try and put them to Red Cross. They have a special pool of funds where they can try and provide some sort of funding for a period of time to help that person, you know, sustain a rental property or, you know, just to help with their living costs and stuff. But, yeah, a lot of the time, if the client's not here and not on an income, it's extremely hard to place. And that would be mainly one of the drawbacks, I suppose, in placing people. The other one is, it's changed a little bit now, but some services, specifically women and children services, won't take clients who are on a methadone program.
What are the grounds for that?
Before, I think because people weren't very familiar with what it entailed, there was still that risk of someone maybe using. A lot of the time, because if people are on takeaways, they get little vials of the methadone, and if services don't have a proper cupboard, lockable cupboard to store it, then they think, well, it's, you know, not safe for other people, especially if they've got children and stuff there. Another one that's sort of changed a little bit over the last 12 months is people with mental health issues. Now, if you're not medicating and stable, services are unlikely to take you. And I suppose it's more of a safety issue that's come around now, that people aren't medicated. Sometimes they're unstable and could be a risk to either the work or not only themselves or, you know, the other residents as well. So some services, there are some stipulations to how you can get into services. The domestic violence services, obviously, they look at, you know, people leaving domestic violence or have just left. So you have to sort of recently, I suppose in the last week, have experienced domestic violence for them to take. Otherwise, you need to look like at a homeless shelter. But there are a few exclusions, I suppose, to why, you know, services. Some people can't access services. We don't have any restrictions on our service. We try and assist everybody, but obviously, you know, we're limited in what, where we can place or help people with if there's no funds or anything like that as well. So
you've referred several times to how much busier it all is now than it was 11 years ago when you began. Yeah. So I wonder if you've got any statistics off the top of your head about the kinds of numbers that you deal with?
The only statistic I've got is from last month, which was our record month of calls, and it was like 6,900 and I think 34 calls or 56 calls. So, and that's a record number of clients for us. We're not sure if that's part of that is because we put on extra staff in November, like two extra staff, and we put on a few extra casual staff on some days on our busiest days. And I think so what's happening, because it's the extra staff, they're picking up more calls rather than calls dropping out, so which is bringing our numbers up. But yeah, Mauricio would be the best person who's got all the data on top of his head, but certainly weren't taking near those calls 10 years ago. And some of that is also because of, you know, economic time as well, people, you know, just being evicted, more of those, and harder to place people. So we get more people calling, where, like I said, you know, like 10 years ago, you'd place someone in the first, second call. Now you may have someone calling every day for a period of time as well.
So that affects the apparent numbers as well.
Yeah. Mm. So data does a breakdown of number of calls that we take each day, but also then you can do a breakdown of number of new clients in that period. So though we may have had near 7,000 calls, you know, only 3,000 of those may have been new callers. So, but, you know, those new calls have called a number of times over that period. So, yeah.
Now, you work shift work, do you?
I don't. I only work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday days. The rest of the team all do shifts. Yeah, they all do at least one either evening or weekend shift. So,
so the service is operating 24 hours.
No, not only no, 9 a.m. to 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So, so the evening shift finishes at 10.
So there's usually at least four staff on during the day, which is what we're contracted for, and then two staff most evenings and weekends. Though there's a couple of nights that have been a busier night and a sad day, we would put an extra 4-hour shift person on to cover the work demand. The busier period. So.
Now, what about burnout in the job? It's not actually strictly a counselling job, as you've said.
Yeah.
And it's probably not as stressful as face-to-face work is in welfare and other kinds of crisis situations. But still, it must be very demanding.
It is, and very draining. I suppose some staff go home in the day and just have no energy left. You know, if you take anywhere from 30 to 50 calls maybe in a day, and when you're dealing with people, you know, emotions and someone who's suicidal, it's very draining on your own energy. Though it is very demanding and you know, kind of quite stressful, our burnout rate's not very high at all. Considering, you know, other welfare services, you know, the burnout rate could be not, you know, anywhere from 9 to sort of 18 months. Majority of our staff have been here for 5 years or more. So, and I think that's because we have such a good team approach to things. We are a great team. We all support each other and help each other. You know, we've always had a team approach to everything. So if you're stuck on a call, you ask for someone's help. You know,
by stuck on a call, you mean if it's really insoluble in some way?
Yeah, so you feel that, you know, it might touch an emotional nerve or you can't deal with it, or someone's suicidal, you feel like you can't deal with that. Someone's being abusive, always say to staff, if you can't deal with the call, then you transfer it to another operator. So, or you know, either myself or Morris. So, so we try and make it as easy as possible on staff. I suppose getting busier, it's taking its toll on staff. But we try and back a couple of years ago, we'd have scattered lunch breaks, so people would take 45 minutes for 12, and when that person come back, you take another break. And what was happening is that staff weren't having a proper lunch break because it was busy all the time. They felt that they needed to help their colleagues, so then they'd be sitting at the desk. Oh well, I'll just take a call. So we weren't getting a proper break. We've actually closed each day between 1 and 2. The first 15 minutes is to try and debrief with staff, try and get anything off your chest, or share information with each other, and then the 45 minutes is a break. So, and I think that's helped a lot with staff because it gives them that proper break. They can go out to lunch together, relax, that sort of area. But we've also incorporated into there a 5-minute break every hour as well, so people, not that all staff take it, but are certainly encouraged to either go for a smoke, get up, go for a stretch, walk around, just to refresh and clear your mind a little bit. So, and I think that helps a little bit as well, so in giving people that little bit of break off the phone, renew themselves and, get ready for the next call. So, So I think little things like that have all helped, in staff wanting to stay as well. So
yes, I was just wondering too if an element in stress levels associated with the job too might be that when you can't solve the problems, you can't give people a solution when they ring up, if that makes your job harder rather than, as you're saying, a few years ago, you could pretty well place people within 2 or 3 calls.
Yeah.
If that affects the staff stress levels, the fact that you can't place people, that you can't assist, you can refer them on, but that doesn't mean that their problem is solved.
No, and sometimes I think that that constitutes a little bit of a stress because staff feel a little bit deflated. We are strong advocates and we always pride ourselves on the length we go to try to assist clients. So I suppose when you take 30 calls a day and you may have only really placed 3 or 4 in a service, it's sometimes you feel like you're not doing your job properly. One thing that we need to remind staff is that we don't run the services, we're here to assist. And if we feel at the end of the call we've done all that we can, then that's all we can provide. So, we're not miracle workers and we can't just get accommodation out of the hat. But if we've given them some suggestions, we've helped them, we've listened and made them feel there is a little bit of hope, then at the end of the day we have done our job. So, and that's what we've got to keep reminding each other, that we aren't miracle workers, we don't run these services, all we can do is the best we can for the clients. So, but it is, I think it does play on people's minds a little bit, especially you hear people say, oh, I haven't placed anyone today, and it may have just meant that they put them up in a motel, but even that is, they're, at least they've got accommodation for the night. So, but yeah, the one thing we've got to remind ourselves is that we're not miracle workers. There's no accommodation, there's not much that we can do. So as long as at the end of that call we feel that we've given that person all the information we can and helped as much as we can, then that's all we can do. So,
Now, which agencies do you work with primarily? Are there some that you work with really particularly?
We have a ring around list each day. So we ring all the crisis services in the Sydney sort of area each day. So we build good rapport with those services. So they might be like a Mission Australia Centre or St Vincent de Paul Service, Salvation Army. So, and then some refuges are just independently run by a collective or whatever as well. So we deal with them on a daily basis. So we've got usually good rapport with all those services. And then most of the Department of Housing offices we have good rapport with. We work with them virtually every day as well. We have virtually every office in the Sydney area ringing. So that'd be the main sort of services that we would work with. And then, it just says other people call in, like some Centrelink offices. We don't speak to them as regularly, or police stations. We certainly have good ties with RPA and St Vincent's Hospital, because they have a lot of homeless persons frequent their services. And Cana Communities as well, which is an organisation who it's like a church-based sort of organisation, but they set up some free overnight shelters during the week. So we've got pretty close ties for them as well. We do a lot of their screening for their clients, you know, make sure, because they're only volunteer-run services, people that run them are only volunteers giving up their own time and not changing welfare. So we sort of, you know, pretty much are the screening process to make sure that we're not putting someone in there that might be, you know, a risk to the volunteer or other staff, other residents there. So yeah, so we'd have pretty close ties with them, and then obviously the YWCA brokerage program.
YWCA brokerage program.
Yeah.
And so what's the brokerage program about?
That's the City of Sydney have tendered that brokerage program. Like, initially there was four brokers that were tendered out for the service, and that's where I originally started from. And that originally it was set up for those who were long-term homeless to try and exit them out of homeless, so you try and get them into boarding houses and things like that. Though about, it must be close to 8 or 9 years ago now, it was decided that it'd be better to have the one brokerage program. And the sort of the focus changed a little bit from long-term helping the long-term homeless to helping those who've never been homeless before, to prevent them being into SAP services and to try and exit them out of homelessness straight away.
So to stop them becoming a long-term client of yours.
There was a tender process, and the YWCA won that tender with the City and Department of Housing. And what the aim is to there is that we homeless persons would refer on to the brokerage program. And then they would then work with that person for a 2-week period, maybe not that long, but it would be sort of like a maximum sort of 2 weeks, and try and get them into either like a boarding house, more medium to long-term service, maybe helping with rent or bond, you know, if they find a service. And a lot of that is also helping people with fares back into interstate and sometimes back to even New Zealand if they've got housing there. So prevent them being homeless and using up beds in the Sydney area if they've got somewhere to go to, or permanent accommodation also is to assist them back into that accommodation in that way. But yeah, a lot of the time it's just trying to get them into more permanent sort of housing. So they do a lot of like helping with rent and bond, well, not so much bond, but rent into, you know, a boarding house, that sort of stuff. So try and get something a little bit more stable for that person. So we've been working with them quite extensively for some time now too. So we have really good rapport with Carol and Nick over there. So
what brought you into this kind of work in general? I mean, when you finished school, what did you plan on doing?
I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but when I left school, I was offered an apprenticeship in architectural drafting, which I had started, and I did a few years there. Though the company I worked for went into receivership, so I decided then I'd go do a counselling course. At that time, during my apprenticeship, I started doing some volunteer work with a youth organisation, Youth Off the Streets. And went out once a week on a food van with them, and I thought, oh, you know, it's something I sort of had a passion for. I wanted to sort of help people. So when the company went to receivership, I decided to go to a counselling course, and I continued my voluntary work. And then I was offered a job with Youth of the Street, so then I became a youth worker with them for some time. And then it just grew from there. I loved doing that sort of stuff. I went out and helped set up a drug and alcohol program with them as well for young people, and was out there for a year, and then was offered the senior youth worker position / coordinator position back at the refuge. So I did that, and during that time I sort of felt like I was burning out a little bit with doing the face-to-face work, and I wasn't giving the energy I needed to the kids. So I decided to sort of move on, and that's when I took a position with one of the brokerage programs working with more adults. I was there with Anglicare for about 9 months, and worked quite extensively with HPIC, and had just flagged with them that, you know, if anything sort of come up, you know, I'd sort of be interested in working with them, and so they offered me a job here, and yeah, so it all led from there. So I've been here now for 11 years. So.
And your title is Senior Referral Officer?
Senior Referral Officer, yeah. Oh. So I'm sort of, yeah, Morris is a coordinator, and so then, I'm the next sort of senior staff member, and my role is more sort of, you know, more the team leader sort of role, I suppose, you know, looking after more staff, addressing, helping them if there's any issues, doing supervision with them, and some more admin side. So I do sort of finances, rostering, that sort of stuff. So.
And you also do some of the, take some of the calls.
Yeah, and the calls as well. So in between, so yeah, and then help Morris out wherever I can. So. So it's always very busy. Never a dull moment in there.
Looks like it might be getting busier because we're apart from the acute stress on housing in Sydney at least and other parts of New South Wales in the last few years, we're also entering a recession, so
yeah.
It may be that things get even tighter.
Yeah, and definitely. And like I often say to staff, I can't see how this will ever end. I don't think there'll be an end to homelessness. If anything, our job's just going to get busier and busier. The only problem is that we've got no places to place people anymore. So I suppose that's our hardest part of our job is just trying to find accommodation to place these clients. So
you're looking towards getting more and more and more and more calls and being able to solve fewer and fewer homeless problems.
Yeah, so which I suppose is the hardest part because you sort of think, you know, well, we're here to try and get people accommodation, but if we can't do that, you know, are we doing our job sometimes? But, you know, sometimes it's just helping people. And we build good rapport with some clients. Sometimes, you know, have clients who just ring us because they just want to talk. So, you know, so you tend to grow some strong bonds with some clients, even though you could walk past them a million times in the street and never know who they were.
You never know what they look like.
No. But, you know, so that sometimes we're the only person that person may feel comfortable with, their only sort of support, I suppose. So, you know, so sometimes it's good that they ring and, you know, feel that they can say things to us and talk to us about stuff, even though that's not our role and when it is busy, you don't have the time to chat. But, you know, it's good that they feel comfortable enough to ring us if they've got any concerns. So, and some people get into long-term housing and still ring every now and then to give us an update of where they're up to and stuff.
Well,
so,
that must be nice.
Yeah. Hmm. It's strange when you sort of, you feel like you know that person so well, but then you could, yeah, like I said, you could walk past them in the street and have no idea who they were. You know, so, yeah.
Well, that sounds like a good spot to end. Thank you very much.